Clinical Conversations IBD aims to provide healthcare professionals practical information on implementing evidence-based, guidelines-recommended care for patients. In this podcast, we'll hear from internist Dr. Daron Schneider, Chief Patient Safety and Quality Officer for Abingdon Health, and gastroenterologist Dr. Sununda Kane, Professor of Medicine at the Mayo Clinic.
So, good morning, Susie. We're delighted to have you here to talk about a increasingly common condition here in the United States and around the world, and that's IBD, or inflammatory bowel disease. So welcome to the conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate the time and look forward to a really collaborative discussion.
Yeah, well, thank you. And so inflammatory bowel disease is a tricky condition. You know, as a primary care doctor myself, I'm a general internist. I see a fair amount of patients who have GI symptoms. And so why don't we start the conversation with exactly that, patients who are presenting who are not diagnosed, right? So
right.
They would present to me, right? They wouldn't necessarily come to you as the first point of contact with their healthcare system, right? I'm assuming most of your patients are referrals, right, from primary care docs?
Well, actually, some have such prolonged and distressing symptoms that they come straight to a gastroenterologist. Some have not been to a primary internist for a long time. They feel like they were otherwise healthy because, as you know, this can be a diagnosis that we make in folks who are younger, meaning, you know, less than 35. So they may not have a relationship with an internist. But you're right that most will have some vague symptoms and present to you first, correct?
Yeah, and I think that's the opportunity here for us this morning is to help really the folks who are on the front lines understand some of those early symptoms, understand how to appropriately help people, you know, get to the care that they need sooner rather than later. Let's talk about that. So, patients that I see who have early symptoms, some of them have symptoms that are so early that there is an overlap between what is theoretically in a differential diagnosis of other conditions, such as lactose intolerance or irritable bowel syndrome, and celiac disease. And I'm wondering if you can just help us understand a little bit about that overlap and what a primary should do with the patient who's presenting with these relatively earlier symptoms that may be nonspecific, and how do we walk through that encounter with a patient in a manner that
sure.
sort of makes sense?
Right. So, I mean, as you know, everything starts with a good history. And, you know, that would include, you know, a significant change in bowel habits, nocturnal stools. So anytime that somebody's getting up in the middle of the night to have a bowel movement, that's going to be pathology. That is not irritable bowel syndrome or celiac. A patient who has unintentionally lost weight, a patient who's having fevers, that the pain, you want to know if they're having pain and is it in relation to food or is it all the time? Does it get relieved after they've evacuated their bowels? Do they have funny rashes? Do they have eye symptoms? Do they have, you know, joint pains that make you think that maybe there's something more systemic than just, you know, a GI type of situation? And then, you know, after the history, and you want to know whether this has been going on for 5 days or 3 weeks or 3 months. And, you know, because in the differential is still going to be, you know, prolonged food poisoning. So, you know, a bacterial infection or colitis, a norovirus or enterovirus. And then with your physical exam, you know, do they look well nourished? Do they look comfortable? Did they have to get up in the middle of the interview to go have a bowel movement? Do they have signs of you know, unintentional weight loss? And then that's when you start thinking, okay, what kind of testing do I want to do based on my history and physical?
So I love the list that you provided, and I'd like to, just from the sake of clarity and education, go over what you inherently may be calling some red flags, right? So red flags, may be found in the history, and you discussed nocturnal diarrhea, nocturnal symptoms that wake people up. That should be a red flag. Weight loss should be a red flag. You know, people who have systemic symptoms such as fever, not seen with celiac disease or irritable bowel, right? And then, of course, you have all the other extra colonic or extra GI manifestations as well that you alluded to, whether patients have eye symptoms or skin manifestations or arthralgias. So in that light, I think that's very helpful for the primary care doc, and it's analogous to other conditions such as low back pain that we see frequently. The internist, the family doc, the troops on the front line do need to sort out, you know, the more likely situation where we might have mechanical low back pain versus others which might be more significant, such as a herniated disc or an epidural abscess. So the concept of red flags, doing a good history, doing a good physical exam, is one that clearly should resonate with us. So thank you for that. As we increase the amount of history that is sending us, you know, to think about red flags, you alluded to a workup. As we all know, we are trying to move towards rational testing, rational use of imaging, you know, high value care, and choosing wisely, right? So for us on the front lines, help us think through what might be a basic workup for the patient who has, you know, let's take the easiest situation, or perhaps the hardest situation, where people do not have the red flags. Right? The red flags make it maybe a little bit easier, but patients are going to present, I imagine, early on with some nonspecific symptoms, right? That are within. Yeah. So, do you have any words of wisdom for us as it relates to, you know, maybe some basic testing that should be done for people? Yeah.
I think you'd agree that. That, you know, starting like you said, with the basics, you know, so a CBC with understanding is there anemia, and if there is anemia, is it microcytic to suggest iron deficiency, or is it a normocytic suggesting maybe some smoldering chronic, you know, inflammation? Macrocytic makes you think of a B12 or folate deficiency that may just now be manifesting. You know, if a platelet count is high, then that's an acute phase reactant. So you can get a lot of bang for your buck from just a simple CBC. If you get the differential, you know, is there a high eosinophilic count that makes you think that this could be either drug-induced or infectious or autoimmune? You know, you've got those three in your differential. A metabolic panel, which would include potassium if the patient is complaining of diarrhea. You know, are they, you know, going enough that they're losing, you know, that they've got some electrolyte imbalance? You know, is their creatinine up, you know, so that they're dehydrated or volume depleted from so much diarrhea? And then, of course, you want to know what their albumin is. Are they, you know, maybe is there a protein losing enteropathy component, or they're just not eating because of pain and diarrhea, they're trying to avoid their symptoms. And so you're looking for those red flags in the, you know, in the lab workup. A TSH, you know, just to check thyroid, that's the master, you know, so we learned in medical school, the master gland, and certainly hypo or hyperthyroidism can give you a myriad of GI symptoms. And then I think it's become so standard now, because celiac is estimated to be in one in every 23 or 24 people in the U.S. now, that it is not unreasonable to go ahead and check a TTG as a marker for potential celiac disease. So I think that, and part of the metabolic panel would also be liver enzymes. So the transaminases to look to see whether there's any abnormality there. But I think that, and then a stool sample. So stool sample for white cells, but better yet, if you're worried about inflammation, either fecal lactoferrin or calprotectin. Those are stable proteins that are found in the stool. that are a marker, very sensitive but not specific for inflammation. And why I like those protein markers better than a white cell count is because they are not, it's not much more expensive to do that, and that these proteins are much more stable in the stool than trying to do a white blood cell count.
So that is very helpful. I just want to review really what you said there is some basics. So CBC, a lot of information that you could get, really looking at the size of the cells, can point you one way or the other, platelet count, et cetera, can help you with understanding if there's any inflammation. CMP, a complete panel, will allow you to see the effects of the diarrhea. If there is prolonged diarrhea, hypokalemia, liver function abnormalities, you'll be able to see if there's low albumin, to tell you a little bit about the impact here. And I wanted to tease out you're bringing out the idea of gut inflammation, and just your thoughts about a SED rate, a CRP. Is there any role for those? Right. Yeah.
Sure. So that's an interesting question, and I think that's going to be based on your history and your physical. So if you really feel that there is an inflammatory component, or that's fairly high on your differential, then a CRP can be very helpful. Although the problem with CRP, again, is because it is so sensitive that if you just recently slammed your hand in a car door, your CRP is going to go up. If you have issues with, cardiac disease, your CRP may be elevated. So I'm a little wary of doing a CRP as one of my first line tests, because if it's positive, it may falsely lead me down a trail of inflammation where it may have just been a variant for one or two days and not a marker of chronic inflammation going on. So not unreasonable. It's not actually part of my first, initial workup. I would rather have the stool inflammatory markers than the CRP from the serum.
Yeah. So it sounds like if you have no red flags, if your exam is relatively benign, get the more basic blood panel, as you described, in the stool white cell. And so the point also then about the issue of the sensitivity versus the specificity is that these markers of inflammation are so sensitive that, it may lead you to a much more aggressive workup than may be needed, and at least for us on the front lines, a good majority of patients. So really think about those red flags and have them be a guide to the workup. The calprotectin and the lactoferrin, I think, are relatively newer on the landscape for us within the primary care community, the family medicine doc, the internist, and I love your comment about how these are not super expensive tests, right? So that hopefully would be a takeaway for folks to be able to add them in addition to the white cells as appropriate. And then just to finish that off, I believe you had alluded earlier to the idea of not forgetting about infectious colitis or infectious processes as well, and then if you're checking stool, perhaps think about that and community acquired C. diff or longstanding parasitic conditions. So an ONP,
right,
et cetera, would potentially also be of some value.
Right.
So is do you have any words here as we're thinking about maybe closing up this section as it relates to anything that you have seen in your practice where there has been delays in diagnosis at their primary care level that you want to maybe just encapsulate for us any differently than we already have? I think it was very elegant the way we went to the red flags, the very cogent workup, and we didn't talk about imaging, by the way, so we may want to just talk
right.
about that for a moment. But,
right, right.
Before we get to that, any other sort of...
So we've actually done some work in this area where we've compared the length of time for a female who has isolated small bowel disease to get her diagnosis versus a male who has isolated small bowel Crohn's disease, and it was about 18 months. And that we think that that's because women, and the reason that I bring this up is because that, you know, if you get a CBC and you've got a woman there and that she's anemic, and particularly if it's iron deficiency anemia, that, oh, she's menstruating, you know, and that it gets written off as menstrual loss, as opposed to, hey, there might be something going on in her GI tract. Most women they may be iron deficient, but they shouldn't be anemic unless they have a real history of menorrhagia or metrorrhagia. And that would be something that you'd want to make sure that you've asked, because women shouldn't be anemic otherwise.
Very, very helpful. And there may be some gender bias there as well that might be underlying that, and maybe some confusion about stress and irritable bowel syndrome that may
be
top of mind. And so very, very helpful. So as we get towards the end of this question for the diagnosis part of the podcast, any words about imaging, at the internist level, at the primary care level? I'm sure you've seen the whole gamut of what people have done, starting with plain films to ultrasounds, to CT, MR, nothing.
Right.
Help us really think through: should we be doing imaging at the primary care level, or should we be referring? Selective use of
I think that, if you come in and you've got, bloating or abdominal pain or something fairly nonspecific, but there's, a little bit of unintentional weight loss, the patient's certainly going to be worried that they have cancer, right? So, but if the patient has abdominal pain and cramping, and they say they only have a bowel movement once every 4 days, which, by the way, can happen in Crohn's disease, that imaging is not an unreasonable thing to do, because, again, your history and your physical help you guide towards what your differential is, but then also what testing you're going to do. And certainly if there's any of these red flags that come up in your discussion or on your physical exam or on the blood work, that you don't it doesn't have to necessarily be a gastroenterologist who orders a CT scan. That if you've got a somebody who's got a little bump in their liver enzymes, an ultrasound of the gallbladder is non-invasive and fairly easy to do. So imaging, with CT scan, if it's a younger patient, an MRI, and then an ultrasound, I think, and then a plain film for anybody who you suspect may just be constipated, and that you can just show them a picture and say, look at all this stool inside your colon, we got to help you poop. I think are all extremely reasonable and things that are done at the primary care level, with good rationale.
Perfect. And just one last question in this section. Any of the above different as you think about UC or ulcerative colitis versus Crohn's? Do we have to think at all, about, the presentation, the workup, the history, et cetera? Or can we think about them together?
So we're talking about, IBD here, which historically includes ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. Ulcerative colitis is a condition that is limited to the colon, and it's a mucosal disease, and so you're much more likely to have bleeding and diarrhea than you are some of the other vague nonspecific symptoms. So it's the blood that drives patients to their primary care physician, and certainly the stool samples become much more important when there's visible blood, and there may be a quicker trigger that's pulled to get that patient to a gastroenterologist, or at least to order that open access endoscopy, which we haven't talked about yet, if ulcerative colitis is in the differential as opposed to Crohn's disease, which historically has been more proximal in location in the GI tract, and so is going to less likely present with bleeding, but it would be anemia because it would be occult bleeding.
Right. So that's clearly a trigger to get them over to you. And and you are right. We didn't talk about colonoscopy. That's not something that we do in the primary world, primary care level, endo or colon. Maybe just say a few words about your thinking as it relates to when that patient comes to you. Are there any triggers that would be, besides the bleeding, really moving you towards a luminal exam earlier rather than later, at least from what the primary care doc should know as they're listening to this podcast.
Right. So I think that we'd both agree that bleeding automatically triggers some sort of endoscopic examination. Now, the question is that going to be a flexible sigmoidoscopy versus a full colonoscopy? And I think that depends on the age of the patient. And then we didn't even talk about, in terms of the history, a family history. So is there a family history for Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis? That is a piece of information that's going to push you to refer or to do testing much more quickly than somebody who doesn't have that family history. Because as we know, that this is a condition, these are conditions that are do carry a genetic component. These are not genetic conditions, but that you are more likely to have it if there is a family member that has it as well. If the patient is over 45 or 50 and has not had a screening colonoscopy, then you'd want to do a full colonoscopy. If there is just a lot of hematochezia, not necessarily a lot of diarrhea, or if they're constipated and they have hematochezia, then a flexible sigmoidoscopy would suffice, particularly in a patient who's under 35 and not necessarily even anemic.
Very, very helpful. So, Susie, thank you so much. I think in the last 20 minutes we were able to go through the history taking, the use of red flags. You were very clear. You gave us a list, physical examination to think outside of the GI tract, make sure you do a good skin exam, look at the eyes, really think broadly, and then a very cogent workup and how to think about really moving forward with an eye for high-value care. So I think that this was very helpful. And we'll leave it there. Thanks.
Okay. Well, thank you. Great talking to you.
This has been Clinical Conversations IBD. This podcast was developed for the American Gastroenterological Association by Knighton Health and was supported by a medical education grant from Takeda Pharmaceuticals.